Fourth case for argument today is Hood against Hensley.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please
the Court. Mr. Oreshak, you'll be called when the case is ready. Mr. Oreshak.
May it please the Court. My name is Kurt Oreshak of the University of Notre Dame Law School, and along with Dustin Beckley, under the supervision of Bob Palmer, we represent the appellant, Tyrone Hood. Although Mr. Beckley assisted with preparation of the brief, by order of this Court, I will be the only one presenting arguments today. Your Honors, this Court granted the certificate of appealability on the issue of whether the Illinois State trial judge's refusal to admit evidence implicating the victim's father as the perpetrator of the crimes of which Mr. Hood was accused deprived Hood of his constitutional right to present a defense. Your Honors, the fundamental fairness inquiry under the Due Process Clause requires more than just a bald assertion, to quote the District Court, that none of these evidentiary decisions by the trial court amounts to a denial of fundamental fairness. As the Supreme Court has acknowledged in Chambers v. Mississippi, and this Court has acknowledged in Johnson v. Schranz, the Due Process Clause requires more. If a court refuses to allow a defendant to call witnesses who will establish that someone else was the perpetrator of the crimes of which he is accused, it must have a sufficient state interest in doing so. Your Honors, Mr. Hood was convicted in a bench trial. The state court excluded his evidence on the grounds that it was uncertain and speculative. Whatever state interest in excluding uncertain and speculative interest.
Excuse me momentarily. Was there a denial of an offer of proof, or just wouldn't discuss it at all?
Your Honor, there was an offer of proof made on several witnesses. It started started with the victim's father,
right?
Where testimony started, and then the defense sought to inquire into a prior voluntary manslaughter conviction,
right?
As well as circumstances surrounding the death of the victim's father's former fiance. Questioning would stop there. Then an insurance.
But the court was fully aware of all this.
Well, Your Honor, the. On two witnesses, the court cut short the testimony.
So the court didn't know what you were trying to prove?
The court was aware of the theory. Court was certainly aware of the theory.
And what you anticipated the witness would testify to if he were permitted to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's a bench trial, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Supposing you put it all in, he said, I don't believe it.
Well, Your Honor, I think...
No. What if you put it, you let it all in and said, I don't believe it?
Well, if it was let in and not believed, this would not...
When he said it was speculative and it had nothing to do with it, isn't it saying, I don't care and I don't believe it and I don't care? What's the difference whether he does it before or afterwards?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference between whether the judge...
It's a jury trial. I can understand your argument, but I don't understand it in a bench trial setting.
Your Honor, the difference is that... Although I could understand that in a relevancy situation, but there's a difference from hearing evidence based on a simple offer of proof.
He'd be more excited about it if he heard it directly from the witness?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the evidence was relevant, and that's not the question. The issue is with the uncertainty and the speculative nature of the evidence. That can't be determined through an offer of proof. The only way...
Why not?
Because the judge...
When he takes the offer of proof, he says, yeah, okay... Having said all that,
well, because Your Honor, the lawyer making the offer of proof is not the witness in the case. In order to judge credibility,
well, there's different ways of making an offer of proof. One of them is just to enunciate it and say this is what would be said, or to present somebody if you ask for a hearing. This is what he'll say. You ask him,
right? Yeah,
but your guy is there, right? The witness is there.
It's unclear from the record whether the witness was there to make a full offer of proof.
Well, he made a full offer of proof. Whether he used the witness or not is less important. And the judge was fully aware of what was offered and the reason it was offered.
Yes, Your Honor, but the judge did not assess the credibility of the witnesses who were going to present that
evidence.
He
said it doesn't make any difference.
Even
if he gave total full credibility to what was put in an offer of proof, he said it didn't make any difference. Is that what he said?
No, Your Honor. He said that it was uncertain and speculative based on the offer of proof. And I'm saying that you cannot judge the credibility of the testimony of the witnesses by a mere offer of proof.
If it gets more or less speculative, if somebody says it out loud or just the lawyer says this is what he'd say?
Well, there's the opportunity, Your Honor, to then test the credibility of the witnesses who are actually putting
forth. He wasn't in the proper sense talking about credibility. He was talking about it's a speculation. It doesn't make any difference. If the guy, however it comes out, it's still a speculation, even if he said exactly what you think he was going to say.
Well, Your Honor, I think the assertion itself that it was uncertain and speculative is a curious one at that, given the...
He knew that the witness you wanted to had been convicted before.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he knew there were some funny circumstances in another death case.
Yes, Your Honor, there were the...
What else was he going to find out if the witness was called?
He would get a full airing and be able to judge the credibility of the witnesses themselves. And not
actually, what you really want to do is call him to the stand. So, like,
I'm sorry,
you could call him to the stand, and like some famous lawyers in a fiction bring a confession from him right on the stand. Now I put it to you, sir, that you killed him. I understand your problem. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I'm not suggesting that federal courts hearing the habeas petition reevaluate every single evidentiary decision of the state trial court. But this court should at least be able to look, on the one hand, the offer of proof made, and on the other hand, the state interest articulated by the state court in the reasons that it excluded the evidence. In this case, you have an offer of proof made presenting an entire theory of defense that the victim's father was the one responsible for the murder and not the defendant. On the other hand, you have the articulated state interest in excluding uncertain and speculative interest. As this was a bench trial, whatever interest normally there may be in excluding uncertain and speculative interest, it is certainly diminished in this case. Unless your other honors have questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Griffin.
Good morning. May it please the court. Colleen Griffin from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. The claim that petitioner raises now before this court is procedurally defaulted because the petitioner failed to fairly present his constitutional claim to the state court. Under Baldwin versus Reese, we need merely look to the brief that the petitioner filed before the appellate court in determining whether he fairly presented his federal claim before that court. Looking at that brief, it's apparent that the petitioner failed to alert the state court that he was relying on a provision of the federal constitution to establish the denial of a constitutional right. The petitioner never framed his claims in any constitutional terms, never relied on any federal cases, did not refer to the United States Constitution, never used the term due process. The petitioner relied solely on state evidentiary law, state cases which employed a state court analysis. Because of that, the appellate court addresses claims solely using a state court analysis. In his reply brief, the petitioner claims that the terms alone that he was denied the right to present a defense would have fairly alerted the state court that he was in fact raising a due process claims under Chambers versus Mississippi. However, the right to present a defense is also one conferred by Illinois law. And when you're talking about a due process claim, especially one that's based on an alleged error of state evidentiary law, those often overlap with a state law claim. So in these circumstances, alleging a fact pattern that might fit in with to a Chambers claim is simply not
Chambers,
enough.
If I recall correctly, was in which a non-party had confessed to the crime, signed an affidavit in the office of the defense attorney, and that was refused, and they couldn't find him. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, in what case?
Am I correct in what my analysis of the Chambers case?
Correct, Your Honor, which presents an entirely different situation than that here.
So your argument, I suggest, is that there you had direct evidence that somebody committed a crime in that you had a confession.
Correct. Highly probative, reliable evidence.
But that is not present in the instant case.
No, Your Honor. And in Chambers also, it was a strict mechanistical application of the state law which precluded the evidence from being introduced. And here the court undertook...
They couldn't find him, therefore they couldn't use it. They had no value at all.
Yes.
I remember. I do remember the Chambers case well. No.
And because Chambers was not cited in the Illinois appellate court, the Illinois court was never given an opportunity to discuss Chambers and on a constitutional.
They'd still be stuck with the rule, though, wouldn't they? Whether they discussed it or paid any attention to it or not, wouldn't they?
Well, they would be still have decided on a state evidentiary rule.
If you had a Chambers case, they'd have to follow it. Even if nobody raised it at all.
Correct, Your Honor. In Baldwin versus Reese, the court indicated that a petitioner can easily indicate the federal basis for his claim by citing the federal source or a case deciding the claim on federal grounds or simply labeling the term federal. Again, in this case, what we have is an allegation that the state's evidentiary law was misapplied and denied petitioner in his right to due process, which he did not allege in the state court. On the merits, the petitioner suggests that the district court did not undertake the appropriate analysis when the court merely stated that there was no denial of petitioner's right to a fundamentally fair trial. However, any inquiry regarding the constitutionality of a state court's evidentiary ruling begins with the general rule that state court determinations are given deference by a federal court unless that rule deprives the petitioner of a fair trial. The court recognized that this was the correct question to be asked and found that there was no denial of a fundamentally fair trial when the state did not allow this evidence to be introduced. In other words, that the alleged error here did not rise to a constitutional level. And that decision was correct. The court here found that the evidence here was irrelevant because it was remote, speculative, and uncertain.
Do you think that was error?
No, it's the response position that there was no error here.
So we're not discussing harmless error. We're not discussing error at all.
No, the respondent's position is that there was no error at all. This evidence...
The state trial court properly tried the case, properly came to the right conclusion and made constitutionally appropriate rulings on the offer of evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even assuming that the long discussion of Chambers occurred.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Even if all of this, the defendant's offer of proof was accepted as true by the trial court, the appellate court, in deciding whether trial court did not err, found that whatever value this evidence might have had, it was simply not material at all it didn't make any fact more probative than not. In other words, there was no direct link from this evidence that the father was in any way involved in the son's death. What we had here at best was evidence that the father had taken out a life insurance policy on his son shortly before his death. He had been convicted of a manslaughter, but there was no evidence whatsoever what that manslaughter was about.
But the judge was aware of both of those facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you said it wasn't relative to his decision.
Correct, because it was speculative and probative.
He didn't keep it out.
Sorry. Clarify one thing. You mentioned the father. He gave $350 to him, right?
Correct.
What time was that on the 8th of May?
That was at about 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, so at about 2:30, he sees his mother and gets the $20.
No, that was I think he saw his mother at 8:30 that morning, and he was going to take his car to be washed. Stops at his father's house, where his father worked, and got money from his father. And That leads me to a factual point. The petitioner asserts that his father was the last person to see him alive and that that tends to show that he might have been involved in this crime. But the father was not the last person to see him alive. There was somebody who testified at trial, and it's in our statement of facts, that he played basketball with the victim in Lansing, Illinois at 8 o'clock that night. So any indication that the father was the last to see the victim alive is not supported by the record.
Was Marie S. Coffery his mother? It says here, Marie S. Coffery testified that at about 2:30 p.m. on May 8th, she and her son, the victim, cleaned the inside of her blue Cavalier, and then she gave him $20.
Yes, Your Honor, that is her mother. I apologize for saying it was at 8:30 in the morning. I think his girlfriend talked to him at 8:30 in the morning, and he said he was going to pick up the next day.
But somebody else saw him at 8 o'clock at night.
Yes, after the Marshall Sr. saw him, his mother saw him, and also this Eric Matthew Shaw played basketball with him about 5 to 8 o'clock p.m. that night.
Mother's Day was the next day.
Mother's Day was the following day, yes. So for all these reasons and the reasons set forth in our brief, we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court denying petitioner's petition for habeas corpus relief. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Rorschach?
Yes, sir.
With regard to procedural default, Your Honors, the state did raise this argument with the district court. The district court decided it was not procedurally defaulted and proceeded on the merits. Despite the state's failure to seek leave to cross appeal, the argument still fails. Under the third and fourth factors articulated under the Paraquet case, the petitioner both...
Why would the state need to file a cross appeal?
Your Honor, it was a something decided by the district court that it was not procedurally defaulted, therefore the decision...
But why would the state need to file a cross-appeal?
Your Honor,
defend a judgment in your favor on any ground properly preserved in the district court.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not sure that it needed to be cross-appealed. I do want to point out, though, that the district court did rule on the matter below and proceed on the merits. Under the third and fourth factors in the Paraquet test, which are either of those are sufficient to overcome any claim to procedural default. To quote the Illinois Court of Appeal, defendant argues that the trial court prevented him from developing his theory that Morgan Sr., not the defendant, murdered the victim. Clearly, the argument was put forth in terms so specific as to call to mind a constitutional right. Defendant argued in the Illinois trial court that he was prevented from putting forth his theory of defense. The right to present a defense is clearly under the due process of the federal constitution. This claim is not procedurally defaulted on those grounds. Your Honors, in Crane v. Kentucky and the state asserts that the fundamental fairness analysis proposed by the district court is sufficient. All the district court in this case did was make a bald assertion that none of these evidentiary decisions amounted to a denial of fundamental fairness. As this court has noted in Johnson v. Sorans, it takes more than just that bald assertion. You need to weigh, on the one hand, the defendant's interest in putting forth his evidence against the state's interest in seeing it excluded. That is not the analysis that was undertaken in the district court. There was no evaluation of the state's interest in this case, which, as we have said, was severely diminished due to the fact that this was a bench trial and that the only reason the evidence was excluded was on the grounds of that it was uncertain and speculative. Therefore, Your Honors, we ask that this court grant Mr. Hood's petition for habeas corpus or, in the alternative, remand this case to the district court for further consideration. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Orshak. We appreciate your assistance in this case and that of Mr. Palmer and his willingness and that of the Notre Dame Clinic to accept the appointment, the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.